This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, where sadly for several clubs at the wrong end of their respective divisions, the past week has been very much business as usual. In the Sky Bet Championship, it was a club record equaling seventh consecutive defeat for plummeting Cardiff City. In Sky Bet League One, it's now nine defeats in their 12 games so far for Doncaster Rovers. And in Sky Bet League Two, it's now just one win in the equivalent of half a season for Scunthorpe United. We'll try and talk of matters a bit more positive as we celebrate Black History Month on this edition of the official EFL podcast. It's Black History Month and we're celebrating it by talking to one of English football's true pioneers, as well as twice winning the European Cup with Nottingham Forest before moving on to Arsenal, Man United, Sheffield Wednesday, Barnsley, where he was player-manager, and the mighty Middlesbrough, where he was player-assistant manager on the 29th of November 1978. Viv Anderson became England's first ever full international Black player and an inspiration for breaking down barriers for generations to follow. But having spoken to you about this a couple of times before, Viv, that's not how you saw it at the time, the pioneering bit, is it? You just saw it as wanting to play football.
Yeah, 100% Clem there, yeah. I was obviously called up and obviously delighted at the time, but thoughts going through your mind were about not letting myself down, not letting my teammates down, not letting my parents down. It's trying to, the basic things, you know, as a professional, you want to make sure the pass gets to one of your teammates. You get your first header in, your first tackle. So it was all professional stuff. It wasn't about being a pioneer. It was about getting through the game, putting in a decent performance, and hopefully getting picked for the next squad after that, and the next squad after that, and the next squad after that. So it was all the professional thoughts that were going through my mind, nothing else.
Do you think because you had embedded yourself in the Forest team by then and been through all that horrendous abuse and standing out, that it enabled you to have a better mindset going into the England setup?
Yeah, I think it did. I knew a lot of the players before, and because we played at different times and we've been friends together. So I'd been through the under-21s, England B. So I knew a lot of the players that were there anyway. And that helped me with the transition from going to club football to international football, I think.
I mean, how often do you reflect on your own role, sort of treading a path for future generations of Black players? Are people constantly mentioning it to you?
Every single day. You must be joking. You must be joking. It'd be picking children up and dropping them off and everything else. I don't think it ever gets mentioned, or very rarely. The only times it gets mentioned when I go to London from time to time, which I do quite frequently, well, I did before the lockdown, is taxi drivers. You get to the taxi rank and they go, oh, I remember your debut and this, that, the other. You go, I'm more famous down in London than I am in Manchester, where I lived for 30 odd years.
Take me back. Mum and Dad, what's the roots of their heritage? Where were they from originally?
Sadly, they're both not with us now. I lost my mother just before lockdown. So they came over mid-50s. My mum came first to Nottingham. She had a sister in Nottingham. So she came to see, to be with my sister, her sister. And my father came a year later and I was born in 1956.
Sorry, where from, Viv?
They came from Jamaica.
They're both Jamaican.
Yeah. Kingston, gotcha. Yeah, Jamaica. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, so we're talking around the sort of Windrush generation. We're talking about the sort of the call for people to come and work over here after in the aftermath of the Second World War.
Exactly right. Yes. My father went to America to earn money. So he left my mother in Jamaica and my mother decided and my father decided to come to the UK in the mid-50s, but my mother came first and my father joined her later on.
Yeah. Why Nottingham? How did they...
I don't know. There's no particular reason. We have no family. She went to be with her sister, and her sister ended up going to Nottingham. For what reason, I do not know. Yeah. And I don't think they know. You just put a pin in a map and end up in Nottingham.
Yeah, well, it's funny how life works out, isn't it?
And thank
goodness they did choose that from your point of view in one of the greatest ever football stories. First sort of memories of growing up, what, council estate, outskirts of Nottingham?
I was born in the middle of Nottingham, and we moved out to one of the biggest council estates in Europe at the time. It's called the Clifton Estate. And we moved there, and school in there. I went to junior school and senior school, all on that estate. So yeah,
unbridled bias, unbridled racism everywhere you went, or happily assimilated into your sort of friendship groups.
There wasn't many black. Well, there was only one black family on this estate, which is a massive estate. But I think. Talk about racism and stuff like that. I was very, very good at sport, so I had lots of mates and lots of friends, and I never really experienced any racism as I was growing up as a youngster. I'd hang around the street corners like we all did when we were younger, but I never had any racism from anybody really, because I was so popular at the time. I don't know if that was the reason, but. As I say, maybe you go away and play football games for school and stuff like that, you get the odd thing. But generally, I can't remember any occasion when I was at school to say that this, that, the other, no.
Mm. Is that a kettle boiling, Viv? Or what's that noise in
Somebody's
the background?
Somebody's doing some work next door.
Okay. Viv, take me through your initial football experiences. When did you realise you were half decent? When did you elevate from a tennis ball against mum's kitchen wall, etc.?
I play football all the time, whether it be at school, putting the bags down, playing with a tennis ball. And I always kicking a ball. Or at home, local park, we played with our mates, as we all did. Came home late at night, stayed there as soon as we left school, forget homework, get on with playing football and stuff like that. So when did I realise I was half decent? I don't really know. I mean, playing for school was an experience. When I went on holiday, I must have been about 12. I went to Skegness with my parents, and I was playing with a ball on the beach. And then some boy came up to me and said, would you like a trial for Sheffield United? So I didn't know what a trial was. So I took him back to my parents. He explained what a trial was. And I ended up going to Sheffield United for a trial. And I think around about that time that I thought, well, it must be half decent if a football club wants to look at me and play in a game, which I did. And then subsequently Manchester United were watching that trial game, and they asked me to go for a trial then. And then once I got to Manchester United, I thought, wow, well, I think I can play football. So I used to go every school holiday, and I'd stayed with, you'll remember, a lad called Johnny Aston, used to play left wing for Manchester United. Well, I stayed with his parents from time to time. Every school holiday, I used to go there and train with other lads from all around the country. And that's what I did every holiday.
Yeah. Still the only black face within the sort of group. Still, breaking through at United, still very much the exception.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there wasn't many black faces. But there was a black face, I can't think of his name now, at Manchester United. And he's still there now. He works in the community. But he was in the reserves when I got there as a schoolboy. So I'd say And a lad called Ian Donald, I remember that name. He was the ex-chairman of Aberdeen. He was a player then at the time. And Arnie Sidebottom.
Okay.
Yeah, he was there at the time as well. So when I kept on going back and forth from Nottingham to Manchester, we'd watch the reserves from time to time. And these sort of It's these sort of people we're playing.
So your football dream has been awoken, but then it doesn't work out with United, and you're back to Nottingham, and what? Not feeling great about yourself, I'm guessing.
Obviously disappointed, because I'd been there for a year. They put me to one side and said, listen, I don't think you're going to make it at Manchester United. Remember, we had England schoolboys, Scotland schoolboys, you know, you had all the creme de la creme going to Manchester United. And I kept on saying, oh, they invited me back. But there was the creme de la creme there, and they cherry picked who they wanted. And I was obviously disappointed because I'd been going back and forth for the year. And so it was one of those things. So I got back to Nottingham, and Mum and Dad said, you've got to get a job. So I tried all different jobs, packing shelves in warehouses, and I ended up getting a job as a silkscreen printer. Now, you're going to say, what is a silkscreen printer? And I'll say, I'll tell you what it is. It is somebody who gets the teas at lunchtime, goes out to the cafeteria, gets the sandwiches they want. And that's what I did for about 6 weeks. And then Forrest came knocking and said, would you like to play for our youth team? So I played for the youth team. One Wednesday, I got time off work, and they invited me back the next Wednesday, and I signed an apprenticeship after that.
And so began one of the greatest ever football years. I mean, you know, so this is what year, Viv? This is what, 74?
Earlier than that. I made my debut in 73-74 season. So it was earlier than that. So early 70s.
Yeah, so you got a little taste of things just before Brian Clough took the helm.
Oh, yeah, well, Dave McKay is the manager, and myself and Tony Woodcock. A great story. We're apprentices. When the apprentices did everything, boots, paint the walls on the ground, sweep the terraces, we did everything. And then Dave McKay came, and he said to me and Tony Woodcock one day, he said, you two? He says, yeah. He says, I want you to come to my house today, this afternoon. So we went, oh, great.
I know what's coming.
The manager wants us at the house. He's going to offer his contracts or something. He's going to do that. So we get to his house. He goes, there you go. And he goes, we go, what? He said, there is a lawnmower. I want you to do my lawn. So we end up mowing his lawn in the afternoon. Me and Tony Woodcock thinking we're going to get contracts and all sorts of things. But
I love it.
But he was he's really good. He encouraged us to play football in the right way, because he obviously the history that he had, the games he played and the teams he played for, and a really good player he was. And he was really good for the younger players, especially, as I said, myself and Tony. And then Mr. Clough walked in the door.
I'm trying to imagine making your debut for Forest in what was the old second division. Not a lot of black players around at that time at all. What, Clyde Best would have played for West Ham, and I guess had been a sort of major inspiration of you. Apart from that, I don't think the West Brom lads had broken through at that point yet.
No, not at all. The only black face you saw was Clyde Best.
Yeah.
And the occasional time on Match of the Day when West Ham were on. Otherwise, there was nobody else. Brendan's a little bit older than me, but he was the West Brom boys didn't break through to that level much later.
Yeah. Brendan Batson, of course, talking about.
Yes.
Bluntly, dogs abuse. I mean, just as soon as you step foot on the field for Forest, you're getting it. Well, certainly from the opposition supporters. Were your own supporters very unhappy as well?
No, my what I remember, they probably tell you
it's a long time ago, Viv.
Our own supporters they were always supportive. Yeah, obviously when you go away from home, all the different clubs, especially North, I always remember going to, and I tell this story and people laugh. I made my debut on the Saturday, and then a couple of weeks later we're going to Carlisle, and Mr. Clough was the manager at the time, and I'm sub this day, and he says to me, he looks down the line, there's about, I don't know how many subs he was, they weren't that many subs, not that now, we've got 17 subs, but he said, there's two or three subs, and he says, Anderson, warm up. So I warm up, get out the dugout and warm up, and within 5 minutes I'm sat down. And he said to me, I told you to warm up. I said, I have been, boss. He said, but they're throwing apples, pears and bananas at me. He said, go back out there and get me two pears and a banana. And I went back out and warmed up, but didn't get him two pears and a banana. But he pulled me after the game and said, and then they put me on, and he said, you let people like that dictate to you, you are not going to make a career in football. So I took that on board. And after that day, things they said or did never really affected me. I just got on with playing. He said, you wouldn't be here if we didn't believe in you had the ability. And he put me on, you know, he knew what would gone off, and he put me on purpose to make sure, you know, I get used to producing my football skills opposed to anything else. Show them that you can play. That's what he used to say, which I tried to endeavour to do.
That's really good to hear, Viv. So to an extent, there was a little bit of counselling, care, coaching as to the situation that you found yourself in. You weren't just left to your own devices.
No, he was excellent in that respect. He took me to one side and explained. He says, you want to be a professional footballer and you have to go through these times. You have to go through this to be strong, to achieve what you want to achieve. If not, I'm going to pick somebody else. He said, I'm going to pick somebody else I can rely on because I need to get results. That was his words. And it was as harsh as that. So, you know, you've got to adapt. You've got to get on with it. And you've got to forge a career. And that's what I want to do. I desperately wanted to be a professional footballer. And whatever it took, I was willing to do.
Were mum and dad ever coming to see you at this point, player? Or was that not the environment you would have wanted them to come into?
Not really. My mum was never there. My mum would go to the cup finals, the big occasions.
What a glory hunter.
My dad would come from time to time. But my dad used to work away. He used to work for a company called Securico. They used to check things around, monies and stuff like that. So my dad was away quite a lot. So it's very difficult to fit in football. When he's here, he used to take me to football when I was younger. But actually coming to games on a Saturday afternoon, there were very few and but far between he'd come.
It was a loaded question in so much as I'm trying to imagine if mum and dad knew the abuse that you were taking, as to they would obviously want to protect your best interests, not know that you were going through that. I mean, did they counsel you? Did you chat about staying firm to achieve your football dream and putting up with this rancid hatred?
Remember back in the day, I mean, my parents wouldn't go to Carlisle or Newcastle or anywhere up north. So they'd only come to home games where, you know, the atmosphere was good as long as you played well and you managed to win or, you know, put in a decent performance. So they would read reports about abuse that I might have took on a Saturday afternoon on a Sunday. But I can't remember mum and dad sitting me down and saying, listen, you must do this, you must do that, you must do the other. Well, Dad was very quiet, didn't say quite a lot, but my mother was the focal point. And no, I can't remember anybody saying, do this, do that, the other, except the late, great Mr. Brian Clough that helped me through that period and that time.
Yeah. Opposition players, were you getting it from them as well?
Yeah, you'd get stuff like that. Yeah. A fond memory, we played at Fulham when George Best, Rodney Marsh, they had all the fair players down there. And I always remember sleeping the night before, thinking to myself, I am not going to let George Best take the mickey out of me tomorrow. And I kept on thinking that. And so back in the day, you always try and get one on him early on or get a tackle in early on. And I could never, ever get near him to get a tackle in. But I nail him about a minute before half-time and it must have been a riot because I'm on the floor, George Best on the floor, and all these people saying, do you know who he is? And blah, 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 you black, blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, no, I'm just trying to get a tackle in. I'm sorry, this, that, the other. So you speak to Laurie Cunningham, sadly he's not with us, and Cyril, and they used to get bullets in the post and, you know, hate mail and stuff like that. I don't know what it was about me. I mean, I didn't like wearing long sleeve shirts. I didn't like wearing gloves. But at my job, which Mr. Clough used to say to me on a regular basis, your job is to stop the winger from playing. Whatever it takes, you've got to stop the ball going in my net. So defenders never, I don't remember, I don't know, Bender might say differently, but I don't remember getting much stick at all from the opposition, or getting bullets in the post, or getting hate mail and stuff like that. I never got any of that, due to, I think, down to the position I played.
Well, it may also be down to, I guess, it seems as though you've got quite a thick layer of armour that you've been able to put around yourself. Have you always had this deeply big picture orientated perspective on life? Have you always had this ability to insulate yourself against that stuff to get to where you want to be?
I think early on, you know, you're talking about 17, 18 year old going to Newcastle United in a cup tie, few games in from playing with Nottingham Forest, going out on the pitch and getting dog's abuse. And I'm just looking at the pitch with the rest of the players, you know, all different things being slanted at me. And I remember going into the dressing room and saying to Mr. Clough, I don't think I can play today or tonight. He goes, you're playing. There was no ifs or buts or, are you sure, son? You know, it's a big occasion and this, that, the other. He just went, looked me in the eye and said, you are playing. Sit down, get your kit on and get used to it because you are playing. There's no way out. End of. So you go out and you perform. So getting that instruction or that advice early on, obviously, give me in good stead for whatever's to come after that. And there's nothing worse than that after that. Nothing else you could do worse than that, is there? So I just got on with it.
Viv, I mean, that Forest squad around that period is a proper band of brothers. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to do the odd gig with you and Tony Woodcock, your big pal. I mean, how did your teammates support you? You go and look at the pitch, they hear it all. Are they consoling you? Were they leaving you to your own devices? How did that work?
Listen, people just say, hey, don't listen to all that. You know, you just concentrate on playing, you know, which they did. They were my teammates and they helped me through it as well. If things happened on a football pitch, they'd refer to the Larry Lawyers, the Kevin Burns and all these sort of playing barriers, you know, seasoned pros. They'd be the first ones across saying, hey, you, calm yourself down. Not me, the opposition. So I had great friends on the football field and I felt very,
supported?
Yeah, very supported by my teammates. And I was very fortunate to have a group of players that were very successful at the time as well.
Yeah. What was the click point? What was the moment? Was it when you got promoted from the second division to the first? Was it winning the league title? Was it the first European Cup, the second European Cup? What was the moment at which you thought, wow, we are a bit special?
Good question. A couple of things. Winning the league, getting promoted. Mr. Clough took us to Mallorca and we found out on the plane going over that we'd got promoted. I think we'd gotten promoted in third place or second place in 9 days. And then the click moment was when we won the league. We went to, I remember we started off really well and everybody's talking about us. And then we kept on going to Christmas. And then we got to Easter time and we beat somebody, I don't know who it was. And Mr. Clough said, I think you lot could win this, you know. And we'd not talked about players, we'd never talked about it when we'd had social evenings and saying, well, we could win. We never thought about it. We just talked about the next game, the old cliche, the next game, the next game, the next game. And then the manager says, I think you lot could win this. And we thought, I think he may be right. I think we could win this. So, and we managed to win it. And I remember Peter Shilton pulling off an unbelievable save at Coventry. If you look at the picture that I saw it recently, the video, somebody crosses it from the left-hand side and a lad called Ferguson, big centre forward, used to play for Coventry, had a header on the back post where I should have been.
Yeah, big Mick Ferguson.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Schultz pulls off an unbelievable save in the top corner and I jog into the picture about 5 seconds later where I should have been challenging him. But Schultz makes a silver that day and we end up winning the league. And the other click moment is when we do win the first European Cup. I always remember Frank Clark. Remember, Frank Clark came from Newcastle on a free transfer and ends up playing in the European Cup final. And he never won anything. I think he won the Fairs Cup with Newcastle, I think.
Yeah.
But and I remember him saying to me, Tony, the younger lads, I don't think John Robertson would be, he's a little bit older than us, but not much, and saying, this isn't normal, remember, lads. This doesn't happen in careers like this. It's a very, very rare thing that you've achieved. And that's the other stark moment that I remember.
Yeah. Viv, the sense of pride from your family, both mum, dad, your immediate family, but you mentioned your auntie already, that the son of immigrants could go and achieve something as massive as it was on the full European stage. I mean, they must have been so proud, mate.
Yeah, of course they were, yes. And even to this day, they mention things from time to time. But yeah, it was like a snowball. It kept on gathering momentum. Remember, that Great Forest team only were together for 4 or 5 years, something like that, and it disbanded. John Robertson left, went to Derby, then Kenny Burns left, went to Leeds, and then I was the only one left there. Myself and Ian Bowyer, I think, was the only ones left after everybody disbanded. So, yes, it's very... I mean, every time you go back to Nottingham, people are always talking about those times. And rightly so, it was a unique time in their history and a unique time for all those players.
Yeah. Can we drill down into international call-ups? I mean, obviously, you had development age call-ups, first of all, you and Laurie Cunningham. It was a bit of a battle as to which one of you was going to get the sort of the call-up for the full cap. What was it like being assimilated into those squads? And let's be honest, you were pioneers. You were breaking down barriers.
Yeah, remember the late, great Laurie Cunningham was the first black under 21 international. So he'd got that mantle already. I always remember we shared a room together. We played, England played Bulgaria in Sofia, and we shared a room. And he'd just gone to Real Madrid, and I remember him, we're going to the room, and he's got magazines under his arm, and I says, what's those magazines? He says, oh, the cars, I'm looking for a car. So he's looking at Mercedes and I'm looking for a Mini. that's the differences. But yeah, it was I got the call from Mr. Clough to come to his office. He said, I've got a letter here from the FA. You've been chosen for a squad against Czechoslovakia, which is the full squad. So I'd been in the under 21s, I'd been in the B, so I've done my apprenticeship, as you can say, and that's how I found out about being selected to represent my country against Czechoslovakia all those years ago.
And what was his editorial comment on this selection? Did he pass comment? Did he say well done to you? Did he say you're not good enough? What was his psychology?
His psychology said, good luck. Make sure you come back fit because we've got a game in a week's time.
Yeah. So that was it. I mean, the build up to the game, Viv, had you been tipped off that you were going to get selected and be starting, or what?
No.
How
no.
was it? No.
I meet up with the rest of the squad as normal on the Sunday. Ron Greenwood obviously was the manager, and throughout the training sessions over the next two days, you know, Monday and Tuesday prior to the game, we talked about different things, and then on the day of the game he said that you're going to play, so I didn't know prior to that, and I remember the people like Bob Latchford, Kevin Keegan, Trevor Brooking, people like that.
Yeah.
They were saying, all you've got to do in international football is replicate what you're doing on a Saturday afternoon, week in, week out. And some, it takes a little while. They say it takes you about 13 internationals to get to the rhythm international football, because it's a bit like chess game international football. So he said, try and replicate what you do Saturday afternoons, week in, week out. That's what they're looking for. So the senior players pulled me to one side and gave me their ideas of what I should be looking to do and what I shouldn't be looking to do. But my manager was really good. Ron Green was really good, and just helped me through the. If you look at the game now, the game would never be played, because half of the pitch was really icy. It was a really icy day, so one side was hard, rock hard, and the other side was soft. So you wore rubbers first half and studs second half. The game would never be played. So it was a very, really unique experience and really unique night for my debut, really.
Yeah, you so brilliantly always talk of it in football in terms and make it seem seamless, but the political backdrop to this, the National Front's objection, the newspaper headlines. I mean, again, what was it like to be immersed in it? And what support did you get from the England camp as to what was just about to happen? Anything? Was Ron Greenwood as supportive as Brian Clough, for example?
Yes, Ron was a different character. He's very quiet, but he'd pull me and say, "Listen, we're looking to play. You got to do this. You got to do." Basically, professional terms, you know. Look for this. Look over your shoulder. Do all these different things, and that I'd been taught since I was, you know, 12. You know, so all he was doing is reiterating what it is to be an international and what is expected of you playing for your country. So he was very supportive. All the players were very supportive. Even the crowd, as it is now, Wembley comes out the side. Back in the day when I made my debut, you walk out the behind the goal and it slowly gets louder and louder and louder and louder. And I remember getting lots of applause when names were mentioned and stuff like that. So, as you say, it was a very unique experience because of the pitch, because of the circumstances. But as you say, there's lots of things that have gone off in the periphery, all the National Front and all the different things. But the fundamental thing that was going through my brain is first header, first tackle, don't give the ball away. Do the basic things that you've been taught well and get yourself into the game as quick as possible. So it was all professional stuff. The things on the outside did not matter one jot.
Where's the shirt now?
The shirt's in the museum in Manchester.
Gotcha. And you got a telegram from the Queen as well?
Telegram from the Queen, Elton John. Yeah, as you go into the dressing rooms of Wembley,
That's two separate. I just want to clarify for listeners there. That's two separate people we're talking about there. You ran the Queen and Elton John together there for a second. You got a telegram from the Queen and from Elton John.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Sorry.
Yeah.
back in the day, you go in the dressing room and there's obviously telegrams there's a big, not like couch, treatment table in the middle of the room, and there's all different telegrams for different people who are well wishers, just giving them support for their night, and it varies from different people. And I got telegrams from the Queen and Sir Elton John.
Yeah, gotcha. You very much, Viv, give a persona off of repel all raiders. Even now, I mean, I think, you know, current generations looking at what you faced would be absolutely appalled. But you just have this persona of sitting there saying nothing was going to stop my football dream.
Absolutely, 100%. You got that in a nutshell. I've desperately wanted to be a footballer. As Mr. Clough said all those years ago, if you let people like these dictate to you, you are not going to make a career. So that resonates with me even now, to this day. You know, you get on with it and you do your best. And if your best isn't good enough, well, you move on and do something else. But my best was hopefully half decent, and I made a career out of it. Else we wouldn't be having this conversation. We'd have been having this conversation with somebody who worked in Tesco's, who stacked boxes.
Do you think the racist incidents, do you think the biases that you faced in any way inhibited your skill, ability, and how far you could have gone? Do you think if it hadn't been for that, you'd have been able to contribute another 10, 15, 20% to your career? Because it was always around you, always surrounding you. You managed to push through it, but nevertheless, there must have been some very challenging moments. You know,
you listed what I've achieved. I don't think there's any room for feeling sorry for yourself or anything else. I think I had to play to my max, else I wouldn't be in the team. Mr. Clough made it very, very clear that you have to play to your maximum every time you play. Training, I wasn't the best at training. I mean, it was all about playing. Saturday afternoon, Wednesday, Thursday, whenever it may be. So training was a means to an end, but Saturday afternoon is the only ever time you're ever judged as a professional footballer. So what you do on a Saturday afternoon is really important. So I was always geared to Saturday afternoons or Wednesday afternoons or Thursdays or whenever I had to play professionally. That was always my thought process.
Yeah. And as if you needed any further validation, Brian Clough, Sir Alex Ferguson's first signing at Manchester United, Terry Venables was your 21s manager, would he have
That's
been
right,
with England?
Correct, yeah.
Sir Bobby Robson.
Yeah.
So look at all those managers that embraced
you. Ron Atkinson
you.
Was manager at Sheffield Wednesday when I went to Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah.
Dave Sexton was a little a manager for a little while with him, you know. So I've had some really experienced, really top managers, and you hope to learn from all these different individuals who've been icons in football for years.
Yeah, I have to ask you about when you turned your own attention to management briefly, and I know you've been very outspoken about the lack of BAME representation in the technical area. I mean, actually, it doesn't say a lot, but right now it's probably a high. If I look down, there's probably six working in league football at the moment, black managers. That's probably better than it's been for a few years now.
But decades, appalling, I would
thought. Yeah, but appalling underrepresentation. Did you, when you went in at Barnsley, you obviously, John Dennis was there at the time, a sort of famous Barnsley chairman, but did you face a lot of bias, a lot of assumption, a lot of misrepresentation when you went in the technical area that a black former player couldn't be a manager?
Remember, I went in as a player manager, so they were getting twofold. So I'd have to go to board meetings on a Thursday with 15 or 20 smoking directors when I got to play on a Saturday afternoon. So I'd get the manager's report out really early. I said, can I do my report now so I can leave, so I can prepare for Saturday afternoon? So they were getting two jobs in one. And it's a very, very hard job, I think, being a player manager. If you listen to people who's been a player manager, it's very, very difficult. But the Yorkshire people took to me really well. I mean, I changed the system. They were playing three at the back and I went to a back four. And it took a while for us to get our feet. We ended up staying up my first season I was there. It was a roller coaster, you know. We nearly went out in the FA Cup to a non-league side. So I enjoyed my time there. And the reason I left was because of Brian Robson said, we talked, we were roommates with England, and we talked from time to time. He said, all being equal, would we like to work together? And I said yes, and I got this opportunity to work for Barnsley, and I rang Brian up and said, what do you think? He said, I think you should take it, because I'm going to be at Man United for another year and the experience would be good. And the only reason I left Barnsley Football Club at the time was because of Brian Robson and Steve Gibson convinced me that Middlesbrough were the place to be, and they were going to build something that was going to be last for a while.
Well, let's be perfectly honest. Let's forget all about the Forest success. It was relatively minor compared to what you and Brian achieved with the mighty Middlesbrough, was it not, Viv? I mean, promotion in the first season, bringing in Janino, the two cup finals, sadly, both defeats with the relegation in that
Thanks for reminding me.
Well, we've all been through neuro-linguistic programming to get that one through our systems, haven't we?
Yeah.
Oh, mate, what a career you've had.
Yeah, I can't complain. Yeah, I can, but nobody listens. What's the point? I mean, there have been some ups and downs, but mainly ups, which is rewarding. I mean, it's frustrating, that, you know, the two cup finals, you know, we lost to the Arsenal. But, I mean, I wouldn't swap any of it. You know, people talk about careers and what you've done. There's not one bit I would change, not at all. I mean, I'd love to have gone to, I'd been to two World Cups, but never played. The second one I was injured, and then Gary Stevens got in and did really well and stayed in the team. First one in '82, Spain. There was Phil Neal, Mickey Mills, you know, experienced, really good players, really good pros, and it was I think they took me for the experience, which I loved. I'd love to have played, but, you know, the downs are very few and far between. I've got more ups than most footballers have.
Yeah. Well, I think there's one thing that any decent human being would change is that no other human being should have to have faced the putrid hatred that you did, particularly towards the start of your playing career. So I'll put that one straight in the pot. Where do you think we are now with regards to equality within the game? Do you think, sadly, that we're still only sort of one appalling social media post away from incident after incident after incident?
Even last week, England plays versus Hungary, their supporters booing the England playing, taking the knee. They've got a banner there showing they don't like the idea of people taking the knee. So we've got a long, long, long way to go. We have come a long way compared to, you go back to when I started, the only black face we saw was Clyde Best on Match of the Day when West Ham managed to be on the television. Now, up and down the country, most football clubs have got several black faces playing in their teams, being involved in their football clubs. It's slowly getting better. You look at now, they talk about Raheem Sterling, we talk about Marcus Rashford, we talk about Tyrone Mings. I mean, they've been fantastic what they've done for black players, racism, all these different things. Even Marcus with his with kids' school meals, stuff like that, is absolutely fantastic. They have a voice. Back in the 70s when I started, if I wanted to speak out about stuff like this, I would be out of it. My feet wouldn't touch the ground. I'd be working in Tesco's or doing whatever I mean. I wouldn't have lasted 2 seconds. But now these players have a voice and people listen to what they've got to say. They're changing legislation, they're changing all sorts of things because people listen to what they've got to say. And I think it's, in that respect, it's got a lot better. And the more people like them can influence other people, the better it's going to be for everybody.
Yeah. Nevertheless, still what we found after the penalty misses in the Euros final in the summer, Viv, it still is a stick to beat black players with, the colour of their skin, which I guess is a reflection not on football, but on society as a whole, as the complete and total miseducation, heinous views. I mean, across society, are we suffering now from the lack of education generations have had as to, you know, Britain's colonial past, the atrocities that have occurred over centuries?
It's right, 100%. You're right in what you're saying there, you know. It's a great example. In the lockdown, somebody contacted me and said, we're doing a piece on the lad called Jack Leslie. And I went, don't know who Jack Leslie is.
Plymouth Argyle, yeah.
Yeah, Jack Leslie was called up. He played for Plymouth Argyle, centre forward, scored lots of goals. And England, the FA, called him up for whatever game it was.
Yeah.
And then subsequently found out that Jack Leslie, an English-sounding name, Jack Leslie was black. Yeah. So they they scrubbed him off the call up list, and he never came from Plymouth to London to be with the squad for whatever game it was. They said they didn't want him because of the colour of his skin. So those sort of things should be in the history books, and people should know about these things. So I think I agree with you. It's about education. You're not going to educate a white 50-year-old male. They're set in their ways now. They are what they are. It's the education of the younger generation. Then hopefully, in 20 years on from that, we don't have the situation that we're having now. Yeah. And the more education people learn about the past, the colonialism, all that you've just mentioned, the better we're going to be as a society. And we accept one another for who they are and what they are.
Viv, I can see you, and you're sitting in front of a backdrop covered in glorious flags of various nations. I can see the Jamaican flag over your right shoulder as well. Play On Pro, this is what one of your ventures that you're involved with at the moment. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I'm the CEO of Play On Pro. It's about, well, I'll tell you a statistic. When players retire from football, 75% of them get divorced within the first year. It's a staggering statistic.
Wow.
Because they're used to going in, mixing with 20-odd people, you know, interaction with different people. When you finish, that's you. What do you do now? Now, there's only a certain amount of punditry jobs, there's only a certain amount of manager's jobs, there's only a certain amount of coach's jobs. What do the rest do? They wait for the phone to ring. And when the phone doesn't ring, what do you do? Now, Play On Pro is a place where you can come to, and we can hopefully get you work. We can hopefully help you on the path to wherever you want to go to, whatever thing you think you might be interested in. And it's a way of keeping the camaraderie that they've had for 15, 20 odd years. We've got an app for them so they can speak to one another. I remember, you'll know these two players, a lad called Stephen Hodge, who I played with at Forest, and a lad called Kevin Gallen, who played for QPR. They played together at QPR 20-odd years ago, and they both came on the app at the same time, and they text one another, I haven't spoke to you for years, and blah, 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 blah. It's a way of connecting with old foes and old friends that you used to play against and people you used to be teammates with, and it's a place of where they can get together. Play On Pro is not just about footballers, although 80% are. We've got golfers, we've got cricketers, we've got boxers, we've got rugby players, men and women. It's important we do that as well. So we're trying to, once you retire, what do you do? 40% of ex-sportsmen within 4 years will be bankrupt. It's a statistic that people aren't addressing, and we're trying to address that at Play On Pro.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it's an area I've done quite a bit of work. I did a big podcast series called Blood, Sweat and Fears, where I talked to former, and a lot of quite elite former athletes. And even if you've made an absolute fortune, I remember doing one with Ryan Giggs when he finally left Old Trafford. He had to be counselled about this. He had to be coached into getting a gym an hour from home so he could drive to the gym, do his reps, have a bite of lunch and a cup of coffee, do his drive back and put some structure in his day. That's a big part of the problem, Viv, isn't it? It's just you lose that structure. Everything that you've had around you throughout your sporting career disappears.
Absolutely, 100%. Andy Cole relates it to being in the army. You are told to be here at such and such a time. You are told to wear such and such a uniform, which with blazer and tie or whatever it may be, tracksuit. It's akin to being in the army. And once you come out of the army, what do you do? And we're trying to bridge that gap between finishing and what you do next, you know, whether it be speaking engagements, whether it be, you know, whatever it may be. And we're trying to help him as much as we can.
Listen, it's great work you're doing. You know, I hope that all continues to go well for you. I have to ask you this final question, but I suspect you've already given me the answer throughout the time we've spent together. But just how much being the first full international black player has defined your life in football?
It defined my life in people like you want to speak to me in October.
No bad thing. No bad thing, Viv. No bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. And to talk about racism and everything else. You must get over the point that remember, racism isn't in October. Racism is there all the time. We need to do things all the time to eradicate it and make everybody equal. That's a really important thing. As me being the first black player to be a full international, has it shaped my life? Not really. Only when I go to certain places, as I said, going to London, people recognise me more and speak to me more. But my life is just like everybody else's, I think. Go from day to day.
It's a good philosophy to have. Listen, I'm sorry about certain aspects of the story that you've shared with us, obviously, but this is all about celebrating as well. And my goodness me, what a career you've had so far and still doing that brilliant work. Great to talk to you, Viv. Really appreciate you sharing that story.
You're welcome, Clem. Good to speak to you.
That is it for this episode. A big thank you to our very special guest, Viv Anderson. If you've enjoyed it, do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name is Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.